Next case is 96-436, Columbus Bar Association versus James Sterner. Justice Stratton has recused herself from this case, and so Judge Klein has moved to Justice Stratton's seat. Mr. Kettlewell.
Chief Justice, Mr. Court, Charles Kettlewell. Yeah, Mr. Sterner, I'd like to reply to you about time. This case is here because of the sanction issue. This court adopts or issues a sanction in the disciplinary case based upon recommendations made to them by the board and the records submitted to them. In this instance, there were 12 recommendations resulting in Sterner's own action. That resulted in a record before you that's incomplete. It's incomplete because Mr. Sterner did not show up for his hearing or cooperate or present evidence he could have presented. And I submit that Mr. Sterner did not show up because of his illness of adult attention deficit disorder, disability, that is recognized as an illness, one which is treatable and one for which he is and continues to receive treatment. We're here on the sanction issue. We can establish, or could establish, that Mr. Sterner has continued his treatment with a psychiatrist, an MD. He is on medication. He is responding to it.
Would that be your response, I guess, to my question that you suggested that there be a suspension instead of a disbarment, and that at the end of that period, the restitution, he'd be allowed back in to practice if there was restitution? But I didn't find any express sort of plans to how we would know. I mean, he's violated the code in a number of very significant ways, and people were really hurt by his conduct. I guess I wonder what would we look to see whether he's changed after some period of no suspension?
Your Honor, a number of things. And I guess the standard is that then reinvest those character traits if necessary. But it would include, and what I would urge that this court would then look at, is whether full restitution had been made. And I believe that it has at this point in time, as shown by Exhibit D and Appendix D, which is his affidavit with copies of checks attached. It would also show that he continues in treatment with a psychiatrist, that he attended, stayed on medication, and whatever the psychiatric testimony would be at the appropriate period of time to show the response to that treatment. It would also include evidence of what he did in the interim, which hopefully would be that he was successfully employed in another type of endeavor, carried out his responsibilities, contributed as a member of the community, community activities, and did those other things that would show that he is back to the person he once was, an honor student, a tennis player, and a father, still a father, but that he has accomplished and dealt with this attention deficit disorder and depression through treatment.
The Vader's recommendation was that he be indefinitely suspended and not readmitted until full restitution has been made. Has full restitution been made? Yes.
It's my understanding full restitution has been made. There was one matter where there was a substantial judgment, but which really reflects part of these problems. Mr. Sterner had not practiced insurance on the civil action. He didn't notify his carrier. It was part and parcel of the same characteristics he got in here. It wasn't something done to benefit himself personally in these acts. It wasn't done to benefit his client. And that legal malpractice case is a classic case in point.
Has full restitution been made, Mr. Kettlewell?
It's my understanding it has, but that $280,000 judgment, so the court would not misunderstand it in his affidavit. The remaining part of that was paid by the other person involved in the case, the owner of the license, as I understand it. The remainder was assigned to another entity, and that entity has then indicated that they do not intend to collect on it. So this court could, if it chose to, order that the balance on that be paid as well. This court could also, if it chose to, say that interest on the amount of monies that was refunded be paid as well.
Is that balance something he's responsible for?
It was a default judgment, Your Honor. I can't answer that.
I thought you said the entity had agreed that they were not going to pursue it.
Yes, sir.
And if that's the case, why don't you just get a general release?
I mean, he possibly can. I'm not sure. But
concerned about.
Yes, sir.
Well, is that the one?
You should also be aware that Mr. Sterner is presently on a suspension to practice law as a result of CLE suspension. That goes back on August 12th, and he has discontinued his practice law in compliance with that order. That's not a part of this record, it's certainly a part of the public record before this court, so you should be aware of. Mr. Sterner does intend fully to get in full compliance with all CLE requirements. Again, in condition of the problems that he's dealing with, he does not intend to seek any reinstatement to the practice of law upon completion of those requirements until after this court is active, and then only in accordance with the court's instructions. So he is out of practice at this point in time. Yes, sir.
Could you get back to why he did all these things? He didn't appear at any hearings, did he?
He appeared at no hearings of the Bar Association. He did appear and have his deposition taken on one of the counts, Your Honor.
Right now, you can tell us that something caused all this.
Yes, sir.
All this thievery, and all these other things that he has been charged with, and not showing up at the hearing and not offering any evidence. All these things are now because of what?
Well, thievery is not a word, Justice Lee, that I believe can be used in this case.
Well, he took other people's money.
He was given other people's money, both in terms of an escrow agent and as their attorney in some instances.
He just didn't deliver it to the people that he was supposed to deliver it to.
That's right, Your Honor. And then
what do you call that?
And then he either delivered it eventually to those people, or he gave it back to the people who gave it. I'm sorry.
What do you call that?
I'm sorry. Black. That would be taking
lack
of money.
Attention to detail? Is that what it was?
It was more than minor lack of attention to detail. It was
give
very,
me a
very serious problem
that you would use.
It was sort of lack. But Your Honor, he didn't use that money for his own purpose.
Is that the criteria that now we have to, if you don't use it for your own purposes and you don't take it?
Your Honor, there's always been a distinction between theft and misuse.
All right, let's get off that.
And co-mingling.
Get back to this malady that he's stricken with.
Okay, is it all attention deficit disorder? Is what the two doctors who have treated him have diagnosed him as having. We don't have the record because he didn't come to the hearing to present testimony in that regard, and the record is void of that evidence as to an adult attention deficit disorder. That is the malady, though, under which he has been suffering for a number of years. Now, he has never said that he shouldn't be disciplined. He has never said that he shouldn't be punished or make full restitution. But what he has done, and it's not unlike what other lawyers have done in the past when they get into this quagmire, it's not excusable, Justice Sweeney. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying, and only what we're saying, is that it's not something for which he should be permanently disbarred. He should be allowed an opportunity to show that he has dealt with this illness. He hasn't shown you. When we look at these seven counts, they all have the same pattern of agreeing to do something. Something happens so that a part of it can be done, and he would shut down. He simply would shut down on that matter, and he would not distribute the funds either to the state of Ohio for taxes, for a worker's employer, wherever they were supposed to go. He would simply keep them. And that was wrong. It was absolutely wrong. He would keep them in his accounts, and he kept bad records. All of which is a part of the syndrome. I mean, it shows this. I've not had a person I've seen a longer track record of showing these types of things. I've seen lawyers with neglect without any attention to deficit disorder, but I've not seen one of this nature. And what we're saying is that it is a treatable illness, mental illness, and all he's asking is the same thing as the bar sought and is seeking today.
And one other thing I'm confused is that there must be a reason why he didn't bring this to the attention of the people who brought these charges.
It's, Your Honor, it's the exact same reason.
What is that?
That he couldn't deal with it. And the way to not deal with it was simply to ignore that it was going on.
He didn't know he was ill.
I can't say he didn't know because he was receiving treatment and had received some treatment before these charges finally. And he knew that he was receiving treatment, he knew he had a diagnosis, but he hadn't come close to recovery from that. it may be akin, although I don't think identical, but I can't say this with any certainty, to being in the situation of being an alcoholic in a partial denial type situation where, yes, I know I have a problem, but Mr. Sterner clearly went on with his life, and he clearly continued to demonstrate the same pattern.
He didn't realize that this explanation might help him and be a period of the hearing.
I would like to think that he would have understood that, but he couldn't deal with it and come in and present it. He came to see me, as I say in the brief, only after a friend of his had basically insisted and rushed my office. And even then, with all the record in front of him and with available documents in his records and whatnot to support his case, he couldn't make them available. I had to take him by them. But he has improved as a result of the treatment. So what I'm saying is those same symptoms, those problems, things that are now diagnosed as being in this category of mental illness, are what led to his acts of neglect. Because the neglect is what ordinarily leads to a pattern, not keeping good records, not doing what you're told to do. We have a number of disciplinary rules that Mr. Campbell cited, each of those, not carrying out the contract of employment. Each of those are clearly there, and they are each symptomatic of the disease that this man suffers from. And his not showing up to make the record was critical in this case, because it denied the panel and the board and this court of the evidence that it otherwise would have received.
The doctor's reports, the reports of the two doctors that you've attached, Mr. Kettlewell, don't seem to give a prognosis, do they? They don't.
No, Your Honor, they do not. And we can obtain those very easily. I have obtained and provided opposing counsel a copy of a recent letter just confirmed that he's continued in attendance. But I'm in that situation that we'll be happy to supplement the record with a full report from a doctor that given permission to do so. We'll be happy to keep our association fully informed that he is continuing treatment. He is going in for counseling. He's on a new medication now, one that wasn't mentioned in either of those two letters. And it seems to be working from what his doctor is saying.
Do you have any impression, opinion as to why the board recommended a disbarment rather than what the panel had recommended?
Your Honor?
I'm sorry, the panel. Yeah, rather than what the relator had recommended.
Other than what the relator had. I can only go on what they say. The panel said, and the board adopted, that the length, breadth, and egregious nature and the lack of cooperation is what caused them to increase. Those are their words quoted.
Right.
And that's their statement.
We don't know anything more than that, I'm sure. I mean, we don't.
And it can easily be said, that's enough. What more do we need? I mean, this was serious conduct. It did harm people, but it wasn't done for the intent to benefit Mr. Sterner or to benefit his clients. It was done because he couldn't function.
I couldn't tell from either the relator's information, the stipulation, or your brief exactly how long he kept this money. I mean, one person went through bankruptcy, or into bankruptcy, because he didn't pay their taxes for them. They'd given him money and he kept it in this account. What period of time are we talking about here? From the time money was given to him until he returned it or until he did something about it?
Your Honor, I'm just skimming through my notes here quickly. There were varying times. For example, when there was a short period, August 93 to December 93, and in Rosendahl, there were monies transferred and representations continued from April of 91 through August of 94, three different transfers of funds. So in some cases, work would continue to be done, more money might come in after some was passed out, and things would go on. In some instances, he kept the money until there was a hearing, and the hearing was negative, the liquor license would go through, and then he would just sit there instead of immediately refunding the money. He didn't run off with it. He just didn't send it back. There's no logic to it, and that lack of absence of logic, absence of a reason, is part of what I believe supports the recommendation that this was under the result of a mental illness, one for which he should be afforded another opportunity.
Do we know from the record that he didn't use the money? I mean, I can't find that either.
No,
that's
sir,
probably stipulated cases to come to us.
There are
the facts that we don't have that we'd like to have, and so that's why we're a little frustrated with one was a disbarment.
No, sir, there's not, his accounts were not subpoenaed to my knowledge. I can only tell you that he has told me that he did not issue the money, but the money was in a mess. His accounts were a mess, as one would expect. I respectfully submit that permanent disbarment will not accomplish the objective. I'll save the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kettlewell. Mr. Campbell.
Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, Judge Klein, Chief Stern. I think the initial question here is what exactly is before the court this morning. I believe that we are before the court here to examine whether the board's findings of fact support the conclusions of law which were drawn from those facts by the board. I believe that we are not here this morning to test the correctness of facts that went unchallenged by the respondent in the board case, or to assess new factual allegations that are not in the record. We are here to determine whether the respondent received due process in the proceedings below. We are not here to probe constitutional adequacy of the disciplinary process of Ohio as this court was designed to do. We are here to discuss what sanction is appropriate in this case based upon the findings and conclusions made by the board. We are not here to undertake a sweeping review of all disciplinary cases decided by this court since 1988 to determine whether non-participating respondents were discriminated against in the sanctions meted against them.
The Columbus Bar, as you pointed out in your brief, took the position or has a position that had recommended not a disbarment, but you wisely suggest that we're the final determiners and we get the big picture and we sort of put all these cases together and try to make some consistency of them. Why was it, can you say why the Columbus Bar believed that in this instance this respondent should not be disbarred but should rather have an indefinite suspension?
It's always a little difficult to speak for a committee. I believe that the overriding issue would have been that with an indefinite suspension, the court retains leverage to make sure that these funds were repaid, whereas with permanent disbarment, that leverage is gone.
So that would have been the reason rather than the fact that the conduct wasn't so egregious that it rose to the level of a disbarment.
I would not think that was the reason. Certainly not. These were egregious offenses. The court should accept the findings of fact that were made by the board. These findings were made upon a motion for default, which was supported by sworn affidavits in full compliance with Article 5, Section 6. Nonetheless, the respondent has attempted to insert into the record of this case through the vehicle of his objections and through the various appendices to those objections, unilateral factual assertions. He has, for example, attempted to tender to this court testimony regarding the medical conditions that may bear upon past behavior and present confidence.
That was not before the bar, I take it, or before the panel. Is that right? And then, therefore, not before the board either.
It was never before us. And in fact, I didn't know until today that he treated prior to
the Mr. Campbell, that bothered me too, and we're seeing more and more of that, in effect supplementing the record after the fact. Should we treat these cases quantifiably different than other cases with regard to supplementation of the record, since this is really a person's livelihood? Or should we stick to the strict rule that you don't supplement the record after the oral or after the argument?
Your Honor, I would probably suggest that the court should stick to the basic, while compassion and fairness towards the respondent in the case might. might seem to argue for opening up the record at this late date. There are other considerations that the board must maintain, and those are public considerations. If the message is sent to the bar that the respondent may come into court at the very last and raise defenses that were not even contemplated earlier, I think that's the wrong message for our general and much public has a notion that this work will give to respondents in disciplinary cases might as a due process that will embark on what other litigants are entitled to. That is precisely the wrong message.
So in this particular case, you would say, would you, that the argument in the brief, the appendices, and the majority of the oral argument today should be stricken?
I would.
I noticed that the report of Dr. Boutros, Ohio State, was dated May 10, 1994, and when he was taking medication, and so that's the most complete medical report that the respondent has attached. And the hearing here was, the panel hearing was in 1996, right? 19, I had it here.
Well, there was no panel hearing.
Well, I mean, the he was told about, or at least notified about his, about the claim against him, I guess, when, in 95 sometime?
Yes, early 95.
So he didn't appear all this time, even though he had been on treatment. He'd been in treatment since at least May of 94, according to Dr. Boutros, and he sounded, Boutros sounded, I don't know if he'd say encouraged or not, but he was on medication and they'd been talking, so it appears that at least during this period of time that the disciplinary proceedings have been occurring, the treatment wasn't doing much good because he didn't stiff-arm the bar.
Apparently so, Your Honor. He had, during that period, at least five occasions on which he could have responded. Columbus Bar sent him each of the grievances, each of the seven grievances. He was served with the initial complaint that was filed in this case, only responded by the Board of Commissioners. And that served with an amended complaint, responded to that, and finally served with the motion for default.
So his treatment is not sort of a newfound event with him. He was in treatment in 90, well, I don't want to repeat, but I guess that's significant. I just realized that if we're looking for some reason to, you know, believe that there's hope for his treatment, that's diminished a bit by the fact that he was in treatment with Dr. Boudreaux during this time that he engaged in the kind of conduct that is not cooperating and not allowing a default judgment to be taken.
Frankly, Mr. Sawyer, we have very little information about his treatment for extortion, and all of that is truly outside the record.
And I'm assuming, obviously, my discussion, I'm assuming that we even consider it to be relevant, and I'm not sure we do.
The respondent has also made claims of having made full restitution. I would like to address that question for a moment. Even if you accept his attachment C to his point or to his objections as evidence in this case, that very attachment would seem to suggest that in at least some of these cases there is no accounting for restitution. I would ask the court to look at the Rusendahl count 5, for example, in which some $21,000 was paid in trust to Mr. Sturr between 1991 and 1994. His response to that is that in November of 95 and January of 96, he paid out funds to the Attorney General's office of $8,000, but does not in any way account for the other $13,000. And by the way, it's interesting to note that the funds when they were paid to the Attorney General's office were paid trust account checks, and as for most of these payments, which were means of inference that perhaps these funds were not in his trust account all along. Also, in the account six network case, the sum of $10,000 was paid to Sterner as a fiduciary, which he was to pay over the federal tax liens. His response to that is that he, in January of this year, paid $5,000 back. There is no mention of the other $5,000. Next, now I can go on other counts. I do not think it is a correct statement that the record, even as supplemented in this court, shows full restitution. The board's conclusions of law, relator would suggest, were soundly predicated upon the findings of fact which it made. The respondent has challenged multiple findings of violations of the code and suggested in his brief that this is a sort of piling on attempt to make something look worse than it is. I suggest to the court that whether there were 2 DR violations or 20 DR violations, there was serious misconduct here, dealing with approximately $148,000 that was received in trust from these various people, and extended periods of time during which this money was not returned to the people that paid over to the person who was supposed to receive it. The respondent has also argued that the board's finding of moral turpitude was not correct. This court in the Burkhardt case recently indicated that there is no pat definition of moral turpitude, but that it connotes deviation from, quote, accepted standards of morality and honesty. I would suggest to the court that the board for this test was well within its bounds to find that a moral turpitude violation existed given its findings, length, breadth, egregious nature of respondent's conduct. With respect to due process, I think that it's clear that the respondent in this case had many chances to put forward this case before he arrived at this court, did not do so. I believe that it sent a wrong message to both the bar and to the larger public in this case were to accept the evidence put forward in the respondent's brief. With respect to sanction, relator has already made clear that it has recommended and has no objection to an indefinite suspension in this case. It does nevertheless take exception to 2 strains of argument that have been put forward by the respondent in this case regarding sanctions. First, the relator would strongly disagree with the respondent's suggestion that the board's recommendation is wholly disproportionate to the circumstances in this case, under the circumstances in this case. He cites a list of cases in which lesser sanctions were issued, but I think that if you examine some of the cases in his own appendix, that is Appendix C, which he talks about the disbarment cases, many of those cases bear a striking resemblance to this case. In any event, the board is free to recommend, and this court is unconstrained in selecting proper remedy which best suits the case at hand, and neither entity is compelled to engage in proportionality review in each such case. The more troubling argument, I think, is his suggestion in his second proposition of law that somehow this court over the last 8 years has engaged in money for justice disciplinary cases in which respondent has not participated in the proceedings or has chosen to represent himself or herself. He presupposes, I believe, that because a large proportion of permanent disbarments are issued to people who are in these categories, that some untoward motive must exist and that these people are being punished partially for just thumbing their nose in the system. With all due respect to Mr. Kettle, whom I greatly admire, I must say that this is an unworthy argument to make before this. this court. It's unworthy because it calls into question the integrity of the decision-making process in this court. Unworthy because it's founded on raw speculation about the court's motivation. And unworthy because it ignores the obvious explanation for this phenomenon and erects in its place a fanciful theory of discrimination against psychologically disadvantaged lawyers. It seems to me that this is truly carrying the notion of victimization on the boundaries of reason. The disciplinary system must be fair to respondent lawyers, must also be fair to the public, whose interests are very much at stake. Unless the court has further questions for me, I would conclude by saying that we urge the court to accept the findings of fact and conclusions of law made by the board, and the court under the sanction if deemed appropriate under the circumstances.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Cuttlewell, you've used your time, but you take 30 seconds if you want.
To please the court, if full restitution has not been made, my understanding is that the reason less than all was paid was because the rest of it had already been paid to the appropriate parties. But if it has not, that's certainly something that would be shown as the reinstatement proceeds, and I believe it can be shown based upon what my client has told me. Secondly, I made the statement that there had been prior treatment. I was referring to the bogus letter of May 10, 1994. Mr. Sterner did not continue firmly with that treatment thereafter. That is when he would, of course, have been aware of the diagnosis, but as the saying goes, it didn't take. Third, as to evidence coming in, there's the Andrews case that says the panel, after default judgment, can allow mitigating evidence to come in. My experience in the past has been to ask, and in the few cases where I've needed to, I have asked to have the matter remanded to take additional evidence at the panel level. It has been denied. I've come forward on the merits, and then if the court saw fit, they have sent the matter back for a full hearing or further hearing. That didn't seem the way to go. And finally, I can't think of anyone who has more respect for the judicial temperance and conduct of the law than the Supreme Court, for whom I've had the privilege of practicing for a number of years. The case law is what it is. The disparity between pro se permanent disbarment lawyers, default permanent disbarment lawyers is there in the case law. It's a result of what I started this argument with, an absence of a record because they either didn't show at all or didn't show with effective counsel and did not make a record. It is based upon records before you that you make decisions, and I do not impugn this court. If a lawyer thumbs his or her nose to this court or to the panel or to the board, so be it. But if a lawyer doesn't show because of the panel wants, then I think justice says another chance should be made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cuttlewell. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Thank you.